And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Ellen Whitcher. Today I'll be reading from The Story Bag, a collection of Korean folk tales by Kim So-un. The Man Who Planted Onions. This story happened in an age before man ever ate onions. In those days, people used to eat people. That was because everybody saw everybody else as cows, not as people at all. If you weren't careful, you'd mistake your own father and mother or your brothers and sisters for cows and eat them up. Surely there can be no sadder plight than this for people not to be able to tell the difference between people and cows. Once there was a man who made just such a mistake. He ate up his own brother. After a while, he realized what he had done, but by then it was too late. There was nothing he could do to make amends. "Oh, this is terrible. Oh, terrible," he cried. "I hate living in this place." So saying, the man left his home and started on a long journey in search of a place where people saw people as people and not as cows. Surely in this wide, wide world, there must be a country where men are men and cows are cows. I don't care how long it takes, I must find such a country. And so he wandered over the world. He traveled deep into the mountains. He journeyed over the sea. But no matter where he went, he still found that people ate each other. However, the man refused to give up hope and continued his quest. He saw many an autumn and many a winter. The man was young when he started out on his travels. Now he was no longer young. He was an old man. He continued his search, growing older and older. At long last, he came to a country which he had never seen or heard of before. Although he didn't realize it yet, this was the country he'd been looking for all these long, long years. The inhabitants were all living happily together. Cows were cows and people were people. They were clearly distinguished. The aged traveler met up with an old man of this country who greeted him. "Hello, from where are you and where are you going?" "I have no definite place in mind," answered the traveler. "I'm only searching for a country where people do not eat each other. Do you think there's such a place in this wide world? I've been searching for such a country for many, many years." "Oh, my, you must have had a hard time," said the aged inhabitant. "We used to be like that here, too. People used to look like cows to each other, and very often brothers ate brothers and sons ate their parents. But that was all before we began eating onions." "Onions?" The old traveler was greatly surprised. "What's that again? Onions? What are onions?" "Well, come over here and see for yourself. Those green shoots growing out of the ground there are what we call onions." The old inhabitant kindly led the aged traveler to a field of onions to show him the sprouting shoots. Not only did the inhabitant show the traveler what onions were, he also taught the aged visitor in detail how onions were grown and how they were prepared for eating. The old traveler was greatly pleased. He was given some onion seeds, and then he started on his return trip home. By just eating some onions, a person will be able to see his neighbors as human beings and not as cows, kept telling himself over and over again. He wanted to get home as soon as he could to tell all his own people about his marvelous discovery. The journey home did not seem too long nor difficult. At long last, he reached his homeland. The first thing he did was to plow his garden and plant the precious onion seeds that had been given him. As soon as he finished planting the seeds, he was so happy that he hurried off to visit his old friends, whom he had not seen for many years. But no matter whom he met, he was mistaken for a cow. The people gathered about him and tried to catch him. "No, no, you were wrong. Look at me well. I'm your friend. Don't you remember me?" he cried in a loud voice. But his friends would not listen to him. "Oh, my, what a noisy cow," they said. "This One really is a cow, isn't he? Well, let's hurry and catch him. At last, the old traveler was caught and eaten up by his friends that very day. Soon after this incident, the people began to notice some strange green shoots, the like of which they'd never seen before, growing in a corner of the old man's vegetable garden. Someone plucked one of the green shoots and tasted it. It had a strange but pleasing smell. This was the onion that the old traveler planted. Of course, no one knew what it was. Nonetheless, all the people flocked to the garden to eat the strange shoots that had a queer but pleasant taste. To everybody's surprise, after eating the green shoots, people no longer saw each other as cows. They saw each other as they were. No longer was it possible for people to mistake each other for cows. And the people suddenly realized what the old traveler had done. But it was too late to thank him for his efforts. They'd already eaten him up. Yet to this very day, the old man's kindness lives on in the gratitude of the people whom he made happy with the onions he planted. The Great Flood. Once upon a time, long, long ago, there lived a handsome boy named Tall Tree. He was so named because his father was a tree so tall that it almost reached the sky. His mother was a celestial being, a beautiful creature from heaven, who came down to earth from time to time. She often used to rest in the shade of the tall tree. In time, she became the tree's wife and bore a boy child who became the tall tree of the story. When Tall Tree was about to greet his eighth spring, his mother left him beside his father, the great tall tree, and returned to her home in the heavens. One day, a terrible storm arose suddenly. For days on end, the rains poured down on earth until all the ground was underwater. Soon, mountainous waves began sweeping toward the tall tree, the father of the young boy. Father Tree became alarmed. He called to his child and said, "I shall soon be uprooted by this terrible storm. When I fall, you must climb into my branches and perch on my back. Otherwise, you'll be drowned." The storm became more and more violent, lashed by screaming winds. Great waves thundered against the trunk of the tree. Then came the fiercest gust of all, and the kingly tree fell with a crash. Quickly, the boy climbed on his father's back and held tightly to the branches. The great tree floated on the rushing waters. For days and days, it drifted on and on at the mercy of the angry waves. One day, they came upon a great number of ants struggling in the water. The poor ants, on the point of drowning, cried, "Save us! Save us!" Well, Tall Tree felt sorry for them and asked his father, "Shall we save the ants?" "Yes," his father replied. "Climb up on my father's back," Tall Tree called to the ants, "and you'll be saved. Hurry, hurry." And Tall Tree helped the tired and weary ants get up out of the wind-whipped water onto the tree. The ants, of course, were very happy to be saved. Soon a great cloud of mosquitoes came flying through the storm. They too were weary, for nowhere was there any place to land and rest their tired wings. "Help, help," the mosquitoes buzzed. Again, Tall Tree asked, "Father, shall we save the mosquitoes?" "Yes," his father replied. So Tall Tree helped the tired mosquitoes alight on the leaves and branches of his father's back. The mosquitoes were also very grateful to be saved from the cruel storm. As Tall Tree and his father and the ants and the mosquitoes drifted along, they heard the cry of a child. They looked into the waves and saw it was a boy about the same age as Tall Tree. "Save me! Save me!" cried the boy. Well, Tall Tree felt sorry for the boy. "Oh, let's save the boy, too," he said. But this time his father didn't answer. Again the cries of the boy came pitifully across the raging waters. And again Tall Tree said, "Please, father, let's save that boy." Still there was no answer from Father Tree. Tall Tree pleaded with his father a third time. "Father, we must save that poor boy." The father finally answered, "Do as you wish. I leave it up to you." Salter was overjoyed and called to the boy to come and climb up onto his father's back, so the boy was saved too. After a long time, the father tree, tall tree, the ants, the mosquitoes, and the boy who had been saved from the waves came to an island. It was the peak of the highest mountain in that country, a mountain as high as Pike Two, the mountain with a white head, so called because the snows never melted from its crest. As soon as the tree reached the island, the ants and the mosquitoes thanked Tall Tree and took their departure. The two boys were very hungry, for they had not eaten for many days. They wandered over the island searching for food and finally came upon a small straw thatched hut. "Please give us some food," the boys cried out. An old woman and two young girls came out. They welcomed the boys into the house and gave them food. One of the girls was the real daughter of the old woman, the other an adopted child. The great flood and storm had destroyed everything on earth except this little island. The only people left in the world were the two boys, the old woman, and the two girls. There was no other place where the boys could stay. So from that day forth, they lived with the old woman, working for her as servants. It was a peaceful life. The days slipped into weeks, the weeks into months, and the months into years, and the boys grew into strong, fine youth. As the old woman watched the boys grow into manhood, she thought to herself, "They'll make fine husbands for my two girls." One day she called the two of them to her and said, "Whichever of you is the more skillful shall have my own daughter for his wife, and the other shall have my adopted girl." Now the old woman's own daughter was the more beautiful of the two girls, and the boy who had been saved by Tall Tree during the flood wanted very much to marry her. He thought of a way to get her for his own wife. "Grandma," he said, "Tall Tree has a strange power which none of the rest of us has. For example, you can mix a whole sack of millet in a pile of sand, and he can have the millet and the sand separated in no time. Let him try it and show you." But the old woman was astounded to hear this. "If that's so," she said, "I would like very much to see his wonderful ability. Come, Tall Tree, let me see if you really can do this amazing thing." Tall Tree knew he was being tricked. He knew he certainly could do no such thing. He knew the other youth was planning to get him into trouble, so he refused. But the old woman was adamant. She was determined that Tall Tree should show her his strange power. "If you don't do it, or if you can't do it, I won't give you my daughter in marriage," the old woman said. Tall Tree saw he couldn't escape and sighed. "Very well, then," he said, "I'll try." The old woman emptied a sack of millet into a pile of sand and mixed them all up together. Then she left, saying she would return in a short while to see how he was getting along. Tall Tree gazed hopelessly at the pile of millet and sand. What was he to do? It was not humanly possible to sort the millet from the sand. Suddenly, Tall Tree felt something bite his heel. He looked down, and there he saw a large ant. "What's troubling you, Tall Tree?" the ant asked. "I suppose you no longer remember me, but I'm one of the ants you saved a long time ago in the flood. Tell me, what's the matter?" Tall Tree told the ant how he must separate the millet from the sand or else not be able to marry the old woman's daughter. "Oh, is that all the trouble? Well, then your worries are over. Just leave it to me." No sooner had the ant said this than a great mass of ants came swarming from all over the place. They had cracked the huge pile of sand and millet, each ant carrying a millet grain in its mouth and putting it into the sack placed nearby. Back and forth the ants hurried. In almost the twinkling of an eye, all the millet was back in the sack. When the old woman came back, she was amazed to find that Tall Tree had finished an impossible task in so short a time. The other youth was surprised, too, and chagrined at his trick had failed. But he still wished to marry the old woman's daughter and pleaded with her, "Oh, please give me your real child for my wife." The old woman hesitated, and she thought for a moment and replied, "You are both very dear to me. I must be absolutely fair. Tonight will be a moonless night. I shall put my two the room of your choice. The girl you find there will be your bride. I'm sure this is the best and fairest plan. Well, that night the two youths waited outside for the old woman's command. Suddenly, Tall Tree heard a mosquito flying close to his ear. Please, said the mosquito in a wee voice. Tall Tree, you must go to the east room. Believe first, remember the east room. Tall Tree was overjoyed to hear this. He felt sure the mosquito was one he had saved during the flood. Ready, the old woman cried out. The two boys went into the house. While the other boy was still hesitating, Tall Tree went straight to the east room. There he found the good and beautiful daughter of the old woman. She became his wife. The other youth could not complain, so he took the other girl for his wife. Both couples were very, very happy. They had many, many children and lived happily ever after. In time, their children and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren spread throughout the world. And again, the earth was filled with people. You've been listening to stories from The Story Bag, a collection of Korean folk tales by Kim So-un, published by Tucker. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Executive producer is Carla Tanella, and I'm Ellen Whitcher.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Tom Hasler. Today I'll be reading from the book The Unbroken Web by Richard Adams and The Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats by T.S. Eliot. McCavity's, the Mystery Cat. McCavity's a mystery cat. He's called the Hidden Paw, for he's the master criminal who can defy the law. He's the bafflement of Scotland Yard, the flying squad's despair, for when they reach the scene of the crime, McCavity's not there. McCavity, McCavity, there's no one like McCavity. He's broken every human law. He breaks the law of gravity. His powers of levitation would make a faker stare. And when you reach the scene of the crime, McCavity's not there. You may seek him in the basement, you may look up in the air, but I tell you once and once again, McCavity's not there. McCavity's a ginger cat. He's very tall and thin. You would know him if you saw him, for his eyes are sunken in. His brow is deeply lined with thought. His head is highly domed. His coat is dusty from neglect. His whiskers are uncombed. He sways his head from side to side with movements like a snake. And when you think he's half asleep, he's always wide awake. McCavity, McCavity, there's no one like McCavity. For he's a fiend in feline shape, a monster of depravity. You may meet him in a by street, you may see him in the square. But when a crime's discovered, then McCavity's not there. Oh, he's outwardly respectable, though they say he cheats at cards. And his footprints are not found in any file of Scotland Yard. And when the larder's looted or the jewel case is rifled, or when the milk is missing, or another peak's been stifled, or the greenhouse glass is broken and the trellis past repair, aye, there's the wonder of the thing. McCavity's not there. And when the Foreign Office finds a treaty's gone astray, or the Admiralty lose some plans and drawings by the way, there may be a scrap of paper in the hall or on the stair, but it's useless to investigate. McCavity's not there. And when the loss has been disclosed, the Secret Service say, it must have been McCavity. But he's a mile away. You'll be sure to find him resting or a licking of his thumbs or engaged in doing complicated long division sums. McCavity, McCavity, there's no one like McCavity. There never was a cat of such deceitfulness and suavity. He always has an alibi and one or two to spare. And whatever time the deed took place, McCavity wasn't there. And they say that all the cats whose wicked deeds are widely known, I might mention Mungo Jerry, I might mention Griddlebone, are nothing more than agents for the cat who all the time just controls their operations, the Napoleon of crime. The Cat in the Sea. Let them alone, Master Richard. Come away from it this very minute, or I'll tell your mother sure as I'm stood here. You just be a good boy now. That's a jellyfish, that is, and you go touching that, it'll sting you. That'd be a right old end of your holiday, that would. And the mistress after me for letting it happen. Anyway, you've done enough running about in the sun to last for a bit, especially if you want a donkey ride. The man'll be bringing them down on the sand in half an hour or thereabouts. You just come and sit down here with me in the shade. Yes, Misty and you too, the both of you. I never did see such a pair of little Turks in all my life. I declare, if there was decorations for getting in the mess, I'd send you up there to that Lord George in London for a couple of putty medals. That I would. He's got enough of them to give away, be all accounts, God bless him. Now you just act right and stop kicking sand about. And I'll tell you about the cat in the sea. That was all along of the jellyfish, that was. That's why the jellyfish goes floating about in the sea by himself and stings anyone that touches him. He's a proper bad lot, he is. Always was. My name's not Constance Cripps. Will you hold still now, Master Richard, while I comb this sand out of your hair? Dear Lord, one of these days we'll have to put you in with the funny man in the Pirate Show. Then you can earn £100 for a tuppenny grin. Hold still now, Miss Jean, else I won't tell you about the jellyfish and the pussycat. Well, you pulls and it hurts, of course it do. Salt water makes hair that sticky. It's like raking honey out of a doormat. There, that's better. Well, now, let's get into our story. Let's see. Long ago, all the birds and animals could breathe underwater as well as what they could go on dry land. And the same other way around. That's to say, all the fishes and sea creatures could come out of the water if they wanted to and pay a visit to the land. And a funny sight that must have been. I should think with fishes sitting up on stones by the sea and horses and dogs all running down into the water and walking down around there like it was Greenham Common on a Sunday. But anyway, by all accounts, it worked well enough. And there was no complaints about elephants treading on mackerel's toes or nothing of that. And it might all have gone on very well from that day to this, if it hadn't been for the jellyfish. Very likely the great-great-great-great-grandfather, that self-same jellyfish as I said you was to leave alone. And very soon you'll hear why, Master Richard. If you'll just stop trying to pick a hole in that rug, now stop that. Listen to what I'm saying. Well, the jellyfish was a nasty, spiteful creature then, just the same as he is now. He kept on thinking, wouldn't it be just about fine if he was the only one that could go into the sea from the land and back again, and none of the others able to do it at all? For then he'd have all the beaches of the world to himself, you see, and he'd be grander than Rass, Bass, and Dogfish put together. At last he got so taken up with this idea that off he went for a year and a day to a great magician that lived at the other end of the world and offered to steal him the Sea King's emerald if only he'd give him a charm that would stop every living creature in the sea from being able to breathe on dry land. And he got it, too, But just what was the rights of that crooked old bargain, no one else ever did know. It was all kept close-like, and nothing to whisper, nothing to dream, as the saying goes. But anyways, the emerald was found gone. And a very funny thing that was, too, for the Sea King used to keep it in a cupboard of coral that had just one crack in it, and that was so narrow that nothing, not nothing, could ever have squeezed through it. Unless, perhaps, it might be a jellyfish. This could go floating past the guards like a swirl of sand and slip through a lobster's claws without waking up the lobster. Well, anyway, the long and the short of it was that all those sea creatures woke up one fine day and found they could no more breathe on land than what a pig can fly. And a rare old taking they were in. Well, the jellyfish, he kept out of the way, but all the same, he was too clever not to have thought of getting hold of someone as could let him know what was going on. That was why, when he was working the spell, he left one creature out of it. And that was his friend, the turtle. So, the turtle could still live out of the water if he'd a mind to, and the jellyfish was counting on him to let him know what was happening in the Sea King's palace. Only the jellyfish was, well, he was just plumb too afraid to go back there himself, you see. What happened was that all the sea beasts met together to think what was to be done. And in the end, they sent to ask the advice of the Queen of Atlantis, her in the western country where the sun drops into the sea. The old queen, she told them that nothing would undo that spell without they could get the liver of a cat and each and every one of them swim over it at a high tide and a full moon. Well, all very good, says the Lord of the Turbots to the rest of them, when they heard of the queen's advice, but cats in the sea is no more plentiful than bears on a bus. Where's we going to find a cat except on dry land where we can't catch him? Ah, and ask him very kindly to let us have his liver, said the king of the codfish, while he isn't using it like. Strikes me that we're in trouble. But then they remembered that there was one beast that could still help them, and that was the turtle. So they sent for him, and when he'd come, they tells him to go up on top and come back with a nice, healthy cat, as they had a use for. And he gives them his word as he wouldn't come back without him. Well, the turtle, he swims up through the sea and goes all along the shore until he comes to a village. And what does he do then? But he crawls up on the beach not far from the houses and pretends as he's stranded there. Well, sure enough, after a time, a cat, as belonged to a fisherman in one of the cottages, he catches sight of him, and he thinks, whatever is that? Cats are very inquisitive, you know, especially young ones, and in particular, they can't leave anything alone if they see it's moving about and acting like it's in trouble. So up comes the cat, jumping about all pop-eyed and putting out its paw to pat the turtle's shell, and then the turtle's head. And the turtle, he acts up helpless-like until he sees his chance. And then he suddenly grabs the cat's paw in his mouth and drags him into the water, and off he goes. All the way back, the cat was a hollering, struggling, and making such a fuss that the turtle could hardly get along. So at last he tells him that there's nothing to worry about, and he's just taking him down to be a guest of honor at a big assembly in the Sea King's Hall. He promised him all manner of wonderful things. And in the end, the cat calmed down and sat quiet, although the turtle took good care to keep a good hold on its paw. When the turtle arrived back, all the fishes and other sea creatures come a-crowding around, cheering and waving, making a great to-do. So the cat came to believe that he really had been invited as a guest of honor. They made a great fuss of him, and of course no one told him the rights of it all. He was given ever such a good meal, and settled down comfortably on a nice soft bed of sponges, and after a bit, he went right off to sleep. Meanwhile, all the sea creatures agreed to meet again the next day and open him up for his liver. No, now you didn't start crying, Miss Jean, because this tale, well, it all ends up a lot different from what you're reckoning it's going to. Sit down. Well, now see, in the middle of the night, the old pussycat wakes up, and there's this cold, rubbery thing a-tickling his nose and bumping up against his head and that. So he says, who's there? What do you want with me? The long and short of it was, it turns out to be that cunning old jellyfish as it come to tell him what was what.
"They're gonna cut you up," he says. "Take out your liver to make it charm with. That is, if you don't look sharp and come with me. I'm the one who wants to get you out of here."
And with that, he tries to take the cat on his back and swim away, same as the turtle done. Only he was that soft and slippery, see, there wasn't nothing for the cat to hang on to. Dear old law, didn't they just try it all ways? And the cat got scared with what the jellyfish had told him. Well, he was hanging on by his claws and a trembling bad as a jellyfish himself. At last, they had to give it up. The jellyfish went off in a bad temper, thinking as that was the end of all his clever plans. But cats are that artful, you never knows what they'll be up to next. It's no good you thinking you'll be ahead of the cat, because he'll be off down the street while you're still looking up the chimney. When it come to breakfast time, they brought him all sorts of nice things, same as what they had the night before. So he just sat there and wouldn't touch a bit of it.
"What's the matter?" asked the Lord of the Turbots, very civil. Only they wanted him to eat a lot and go to sleep again, see, so they could put him out nice and quiet and no trouble. "Isn't it to your liking?"
"Oh, yes, yes," says the cat, acting very disappointed-like. "You're very kind," he says. "But the truth is, I had a very bad night, and it's all my own fault," he says. "I can't think how I can have been so stupid and forgetful."
"Why, what you forgotten then?" someone asks him.
"Well," says the cat, "I always washes my liver once a month. Healthy, you know, for us land creatures. We all do it. And then I hangs it out to dry. And what with coming away so sudden yesterday afternoon, I clean forgot about it. So, of course, that lovely dinner what you give me last night was bound to disagree with me. I really daren't eat no more," he says. "I feels wrong enough now." And then he rolls about and acts up ever so well, so they all thinks he must have been took real bad.
"In it proper real," says the king of the codfish. "Just our luck, eh?" "Dear, oh dear," says the lord of the turbots. "Don't it always just about choose bank holidays to rain?" he says. "Why did that old turtle have to pick one without a liver? Lucky he told us. We might very well have had all the trouble for nothing. Turtle'll just have to take him back to pick up his liver and bring him down here again tonight," he says. So off they goes, the turtle and the pussycat, back up to the village by the sea. Of course, as soon as they got there, Mr. Pussy, he says, "Oh, good," he says. "There's my liver still hanging out on the line. I won't be just a minute." And off he went. And he took good care not to come back, too. Poor old turtle, he waited and waited. But at last he had to go home again and tell them as they'd all been made fools of. And from that day to this, no cat will go into water or anywhere near it. Not if he can help. Because that old pussycat told all the others. And they passed it on mother to child, see? They're not giving the fish any more chances, no siree. And no beast comes out of the sea onto the land, only except for the jellyfish and the turtle. Though as for turtles, I've never seen one myself, and I'm only telling you what they told me. And as for the jellyfish, he goes floating about all by himself in the water, for none of the other creatures will have anything to do with him. It ain't surprising, is it? He floats up on the beach when he feels like it, and then he waits to be washed off by the next tide. If anyone touches him, or interferes with him, he stings them, because he's afraid they've come to punish him for all his mean tricks. But there's no doing anything about it now. It's best left alone, excepting you want to be laid up bad. Now look, there's a donkey man come now. Master Richard, see him up there? One ride you can have. Yep, you and Miss Jean, the both of you. My goodness, me twopence to go. Prize for daylight robbery, and they'd be sending that there donkey man up to Lord Kitchener for a decoration, that they would. Ah, there you are, then, Master Richard. There's four coppers, and just take good care of them now. And mind you come straight back here, where I'm sitting, Don't get to wandering about, nor stand and listen to that vulgar ventriloquist, or whatever he calls himself. You be a good boy and girl now, and I'll take you up to see the Camera Cure this afternoon. And do stop kicking your toes like that, Master Richard. Those sandals have got to last. You've been listening to stories and poems from the book The Unbroken Web by Richard Adams, published by Crown, and The Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats by T.S. Eliot, published by Harcourt Grace Jovanovich. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUACFM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tonella. And I'm Tom Hassler.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hi, I'm Missy Eisman. Today I'll be reading from the book Come Again in the Spring by Richard Kennedy. Snow was on the ground. Old Hark was standing out to the side of his cabin, scattering handfuls of cracked corn and scraps to the birds all around him. Now and then he sniffed the air. Smelled like more snow was coming. A solitary figure bundled in a great bearskin coat trudged along the forest path to the old man's cabin. He stopped in front of the cabin and shifted a large ledger out from under his arm. The burly figure opened it to a page, looked at the cabin and then to the page again, and walked out toward the old man. "Good day," said the stranger. "Howdy," said Old Hark, brushing his hand on his coat. "Your face is easy, but I can't recollect the name. We met?" "Oh, not in any formal way," said the stranger, "but I've passed this way before. Maybe you've caught a glimpse of me. I'm Death." The old man straightened his back and held the feed bag a little closer to his chest. "Death, eh? Well, you got the wrong place." "No," Death said, opening the ledger. "You're Old Hark, aren't you?" "Maybe, maybe not," said Old Hark, turning his back and scattering a handful of seeds. "Well, certainly you are," Death said, taking a pen from his pocket. "It's all right here in the book." "Don't give a damn what's in the book," said Old Hark. "I ain't going. Come again in the spring." Death sighed and took the cap off his pen. "How tiresome," he said. "Everyone tries to put it off, and all it amounts to is making a little check mark after your name." He poised the pen above the book. Old Hark turned. "I ain't afraid of you." "No," Death said, looking up. "Come again in the spring. I won't hinder you none then. But you see all these birds? Come winter time, they depend on me to feed them. They naturally ought to fly south in the winter, but don't. Reason, because I've been feeding them all winter since I was no bigger than a skip bug. They'd die if I was gone. They ain't real wintering birds, but you come back in the spring and they'll know I won't be here next winter and have enough sense to go south." "Oh, that wouldn't do at all," Death said. "The book is all made up in advance. Why, rescheduling you into the springtime would take a good week's work. Erasers would have to be made, new entries, changes of address, causes of departure. Very complicated, no trifling matter at all, I assure you. No, it really won't do at all." "Don't know about that," Old Hark said, "but I ain't going." He took a few steps away. Death followed him. "Here," Death said persuasively, "you're really getting quite old and feeble, you know. Quite past the age I usually visit people." "Ain't going," Old Hark said. Death saw that the old man was resolute and not at all in the correct state of mind for the business at hand. He considered that he might cause a tree to fall on the old man's head. He consulted his book. Next to Old Hark's name was written, "Means of departure, quiet, gentle, peaceful." So violence was out of the question. Jeff turned a page in the book and studied the entries. Now look, Jeff said, I can give you another day. You can fit you in for tomorrow, but then you'll have to come quietly, gently, and peacefully. Even so, I'll have to stay up half the night juggling these entries. But I'll do it as a special favor. Not tomorrow either, said Old Hart. Come again in the spring. Jeff was getting impatient. You're so old now and so feeble, and your memory is so shabby, you won't even remember me by then, and you'll have to go through all this again. There ain't nothing wrong with my memory. Isn't there now? Perfect. Jeff smiled. If you think so, let me make you a wager. Let's hear it, said Old Hart. It's this, said Jeff. Just so I can be sure you'll remember me next spring, let's make a test. If I can ask you a question about something that happened in your life and you don't remember, then you must come with me tomorrow. Agreed, said Old Hart. Ask away. Jeff closed the ledger and put his pen away. He smiled again and asked, on your second birthday, your mother baked up a special treat. What was it? Then Jeff turned and walked off towards the forest path. Good day, he called. I'll see you tomorrow. It began to snow. Old Hart returned to his cabin, picked the snow off his boots, and went inside. He put on some coffee to Perkin and sat back in his rocking chair. He sat there for hours, remembering many things, many smells and tastes and sounds and people. But of course, he couldn't remember what his mother baked special on his second birthday. Some birds chirped outside the door. The snow had stopped. Old Hart got a handful of feed, opened the door, and chucked it out. The bird made a fuss and noise, but just as Old Hart closed the door, he heard one chirp above and unlike any of the others. A very strange chirp. It sounded exactly as if one of the birds had said, plum cake. It snowed most of the night. Next morning, Old Hart made his rounds to the bird feeders and scattered plenty of feed. He got his shovel and a ladder out then and climbed up to shove some of the snow off the roof of his cabin. While he was up there, Jeff came around with his ledger under his arm. He stood next to the ladder and shouted out a cheery, good morning! Old Hart looked down. He put a finger to one of his nostrils, blew his nose in the snow, and then said, plum cake, and turned back to his work. That was a surprise for Jeff. He had spent half the night working on the book. He was tired, and now he was angry, and tempted to pull the ladder out from the old man, but he remembered the words in the book. Quiet, gentle, peaceful, and he got hold of himself. Very good, Jeff said. I don't think there's one man in 1,000 who could have remembered that far back. But of course, it might have just been luck. Perhaps you made a guess at it. I didn't guess, Old Hart said. But you couldn't do it again, Jeff said. I reckon I could. Then just to be absolutely positive it wasn't a guess, let's try it one more time. One more time, Hart agreed. Ask away. Very well, said Jeff. The question is this. On your first birthday, your mother picked some wildflowers and put them in your crib with you. What kind of flowers were they? And walked away up the forest path. After clearing the roof, Old Hart took a shovel to work on some drift that was leaning onto his fence. Now and then he threw some seed out of his pocket to the birds that followed him about. There was singing and chirping around the fence, and as he finished up and headed back to the cabin, Old Hart heard in back of him an unusual chirp, loud and clear. It sounded exactly as if one of the birds had said, buttercup. Next morning, when Jeff came round, Old Hart was under his lean-to, splitting wood. Good morning, Jeff said lightly, although he was feeling grouchy, because he had been up half the night fixing his book to fit the old man into a new place. Old Hart spit on his hand and took a fresh grip on his splitting maul. Buttercups, he said, and swung them all. Jeff swallowed hard to keep from crying out. It was impossible. He would have liked to have had Old Hart's wedge jump up and crack his skull. But of course, that wasn't in the book. Slowly, Jeff got control of himself. Amazing, Jeff said. I can scarcely believe it. What a memory. I'm astounded, really, I am. You don't suppose you could possibly do that again? I hardly believe you could. Old Hark took a breath and leaned on the butt of his splitting maul. I reckon I just might, he said, but supposing I do, then you got to let me be all the way into next spring. Agreed, Jeff said, agreed. Then it's a wager. One more question. If you can answer, then I won't come again until next spring. If you can't answer, well then, Jeff made a check mark in the air. Ask away, said Old Hark. The question is this, said Jeff. On the day you were born, when the midwife held you up in the air, what were the first words your father said? Jeff cocked his head, smiled, and walked away. After splitting the wood, Old Hark filled all the bird feeders and broke up the ice in the cistern. All the while, he was paying close attention to the birds which always fluttered nearby, but he heard nothing out of the ordinary in their chirping. Then he went inside. He stoked up the fire, made coffee, took a nap, and puttered with some harness. But every now and then, he opened the door and threw out some seed and listened carefully. Just ordinary singing and chirping. He was feeling especially tired and went to bed early with no answer to the question. Now the reason the birds could tell him nothing was this. Old Hark had been born in that very cabin, and generations of birds had known him and everything about him. And because of their love for the old man, they had passed on many memories of him, and so they knew the answers to the other questions. But on the day the old man was born, in the very bed in which he now lay, the window was closed and the curtain was drawn. So the birds knew nothing of what his father's first words were upon seeing his newborn son. They could not help him. Old Hark woke late, which wasn't like him. Bones hurt, he felt tired. It took him much longer than usual to get his chores done, and the wind seemed to chill him to the heart. Still, he listened carefully to the birds. They said nothing special. Early in the afternoon, without coffee or even a bite to eat, he undressed and got back into bed. He had never felt quite so tired in his life. Through his half-closed eyes, he watched the birds on the windowsill hopping about, but he was too tired even to crack the window a bit so he could hear them sing. Now and then, he fell asleep. Jeff knocked on the door in the late afternoon. Come in, Old Hark whispered. Hello, Jeff said, opening the door. Then he saw Old Hark laid out in the bed, and understood at once that the old man had no answer to the question. Well, well, Death said, taking a chair next to the old man's bed and opening his book on his lap. Now isn't this more like it? Yes, indeed. You old rascal, I've been up half the night again on your account, you know. But it's quite all right now. Yes, indeed, it's good to see you lying there, so quiet and gentle, and Death glanced at the book, so peaceful. Old Hark paid him no attention. He was watching the birds play on the windowsill. Now, said Death, taking out his pen, I've managed to fit you in for sunset. Oh, you should appreciate that. It's a choice spot, really. Very appropriate, very fitting to the occasion, you know. Daylight ending, the sun going down, darkness coming on. Yes, it's a choice spot. We usually reserve it for poets. Death ran a finger down the page. Here we are, he said cheerfully. He took the pen off his cap and moved to make a check mark after Old Hark's name. Then he paused. Oh, yes, Jeff said. It's a formality, but I must ask you so as to make it all strictly legal. As I recall, then, the question was this. On the day you were born, when the midwife held you up in the air, what were the first words your father said? But Old Hark had not even been listening. He was looking at the birds, and he said to Death, open the window. Death thrust his head forward and clutched at his pen. What did you say? Let the birds sing. No, Death bellowed. He flung his arms around hysterically, splattering incense, screamed out again, and flew off his chair in a fit. He got up in a rage and kicked his foot through the window. Birds flew in, singing. Jeff grabbed a handful of his coat front and threw himself out the window and went stumbling up the forest path. Old Hark leapt out of bed and watched Jeff disappear into the forest. He was feeling much better. He put on a wool shirt and got some coffee to Perkins, then cut himself some cheese and bread. In a short time, he figured out what all the commotion had been about. Of course, what it was this. Jeff Death had lost the wager and must leave Old Hart to live until spring, for his father's first words on seeing his newborn son had been, "Whoa! Open the window and let the birds sing." You've been listening to Come Again in the Spring by Richard Kennedy, published by Harper and Row. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tonella. And I'm Nikki Eisman.